Now, the chief of NATO has urged allies to step up defence efforts, warning European countries that they are Russia's next target. Mark Rutte has also warned that Moscow could be prepared to use military force against NATO within 5 years. His comments come as talks continue across Europe and the US in a bid to end the Russia-Ukraine war. Meanwhile, the European Union has handed Ukraine a long list of reforms needed to join the bloc, despite objections from EU member Hungary. John Foreman is a former UK defence attaché to Moscow between 2019 and 2022, and previously to Kyiv. I spoke with him earlier. John Foreman, welcome to Radio National Breakfast.
Hello, Melissa.
What do you make of NATO Secretary-General Mark Rutte's comments?
I think Mr. Rutte has a history of some outlandish statements recently. Earlier in the year, he was saying that Brits would be speaking Russian if we did spend more money on defence. He also made some strange claims about Russian tank production. And, you know, I don't think particularly his claims that we might be at war within 5 years is particularly helpful. I mean, certainly NATO leaders said back in June that they acknowledged a long-term threat from Russia. And I agree with Mr. Rutte that we need to invest in defence and deterrence, but obviously people read these, listen to his statements and are concerned. And I think it's all be good for all of us to dial down the rhetoric and actually focus on investing in defence and deterrence in Europe.
Do you think he believes the comments that he's making, or do you think it's a tactic to try and drum up more defence spending or put pressure on governments within NATO to up defence spending?
Yeah, I certainly think there's a tactical approach to get nations to fulfil the promises they made back in June to spend 3.5% on defence, 1.5% on security. But I think there's a risk that Mr. Rutte runs is that he is the Secretary General of NATO. He's not the President of NATO. NATO is an alliance of 32 member states, each of which has democratic elected governments. So I think he runs the risk at times of being seen to hector the leaders rather than working together. I think his approach is in stark contrast with his predecessor, Mr. Stoltenberg, who is much more relaxed, you know, and constrained by the use of his language.
We've seen a concerted effort to increase the amount of money going into the prioritised Ukraine requirements list. Even non-NATO countries like Australia have been contributing to that. How do you assess the amount of commitments that have been made to that process so far? How close is it to delivering the kind of support that Ukraine needs?
I mean, certainly the PEARL, the prioritised list, is required because America has backed away from sending arms directly to Ukraine, is expecting its allies to do to pick up the weight and do the heavy lifting. So it's not a great approach because America's so abdicated leadership both on financial support to Ukraine and also military support to Ukraine. I think in terms of commitments, the process seems to be running quite well, but it's quite clear that Ukraine still requires significant support, especially in terms of air defence, long-term missiles, defensive aids, because Ukraine's under severe pressure on the front line, and almost everything we can do to help it withstand the Russian attack is necessary.
Ukraine's been meeting with EU ministers as it pushes to join the bloc. How does that effort fit in with the wider peace talks that are going on right now?
Well, I think we saw the 28-point plan, which was circulated maybe a month ago, that although NATO membership was probably not on the cards for Ukraine just because of realism, you know, America and other states don't agree that Ukraine should join NATO, that EU membership was part of that deal. I've been encouraged by the progress that Ukraine's been made towards European membership. It seems to me that the European foreign minister is also saying that the door's open and the work has been done. I think the Germans were saying this work needs to be accelerated. What we can't do is leave Ukraine hanging in the event of any peace deal without the financial support and the sort of muscle that comes from the European Union to help rebuild itself.
There's certainly some suggestions that the process of trying to advance EU membership is about a show of support for Ukraine at a crucial time. Do you see it as stronger than that? Do you see this as genuine consideration by EU allies?
Yeah, but I used to work for the European Union, and actually I've been surprised how quickly things have been moving on. You know, Ukraine has a clear membership perspective. It's been substantive talks that we know between the European Union and Ukraine. Ukraine's been marching through the various points of the acquis communautaire, which is the part of the sort of process to get into it. I mean, obviously, there's political obstacles from some EU member states, in particular Hungary and Slovakia, but I don't think that's insurmountable. It takes both political amendments and also for Ukraine to finish off the membership process, in particular on corruption, which is a major sticking point as enough concern to European member states.
On Radio National Breakfast, I'm speaking to John Foreman, the former UK defence attaché to Moscow and previously to Kyiv. John, the US is suggesting a free economic zone in the Donbass as part of the latest peace talks. How could this work? Do you think that's a realistic formulation as we look at this peace plan and how it might come to fruition?
Well, I'm not sure where we've all got to on the actual plan. I know that there's reports today of another 20-point plan with various documents between Russia and America and Russia and European Union and NATO. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding by the Americans. They seem to think that Donbass is a real estate deal, that you know Ukraine can give up land and then there will be peace. And this sort of economic zone idea is to sweeten the deal. But it's not really about economics, it's about sovereignty. And actually, Ukraine's been quite clear, it doesn't want to give up land in Donbass without clear security guarantees or clear benefit. So I think President Zelensky and his European allies are still saying that there should be no giving up territory in Donbass, which remains a major sticking point in the deal with Russia.
And when it comes to the idea of a security guarantee for Ukraine, which has been crucial and a required part for a peace deal, we've also seen Sergei Lavrov say that Russia needs security guarantees too. What do you think he means by that? Is that around preventing NATO's expansion or is it something else?
Yes, I mean, I think on security guarantees, obviously, firstly, Ukraine will not sign any deal without legally binding treaty security guarantees, in particular for America, and some of the coalition are willing. And I'm not sure where that's got to. I think we have to wait and see what America actually offers. I mean, certainly on Lavrov is not a key decision maker in the system. He's repeating President Putin's previous points. And this is the demands that Russia made before the invasion in 2021, which they said they wanted basically no Ukraine in NATO, no NATO in Ukraine. They also wanted a rollback of NATO presence in Eastern Europe. Some of that is completely unacceptable. So I think one of the documents which the Americans handed over to the Russians was about NATO. But of course, America is only one voice in NATO, and there's 31 other voices they'll have to convince to get any deals signed. But I think the chances are that one of those agreements will be that enlargement eastwards is probably stopped for the foreseeable future, in reality, if not in law.
John Foreman, thank you very much for joining me on Radio National Breakfast this morning.
Thank you, Melissa.